airplane down that big old fairway. Don't want no hackers to get in my way. The boys and me got a big NASA going. We were born.
Welcome to For the Love of the Game. I'm Uncle Buck. Sitting across from me is a shot dog, and sitting to his right across from me, Mr. B, Mr. Danny Joe Pole, the Polecat, two-time winner on the PGA Tour, Varden Trophy winner, Ryder Cup member, and a trip to Augusta in 1982. T1, and that's where the story ends.
Stop it.
We're not going to imbibe on
right
that.
There.
We're not going any further. But, folks, you know how we roll around here on Wednesdays. Last Wednesday, we had Peter Jacobson, and now we're getting ready. We're just going to start this trend. And, dog, what's the theory on this show?
Go big or go home.
We're going big, and it just doesn't get much bigger than this. We're talking about a professional golfer. We're talking about PGA Tour player. Well, no, University of Texas. He's a Longhorn.
Hook 'em horns.
I got to get that one out early. PGA Tour, Champions Tour, Varden Trophy winner, 7 Ryder Cups, 19 victories. I think he's won more money than God. I'm looking at it here. I'm telling you. I'm serious. I'm looking at it. Right there it is.
And he didn't share it with anybody.
But he had, I'll tell you what, he really had, he had a formidable wall that he had to go up against through his careers, and he proved it. He could get it done. Polecat, any comments on this young man?
Well, I've been looking forward to having Tom on the show for a long, long time because, to me, probably maybe the most underrated player of any generation. And I've always admired the way he went about his business. So, for me, this is a pleasure.
All right, we're proud to announce and glad to have on the show this morning. And what a great addition to the show, Mr. Tom Kite. Tom, how you doing today?
I am doing great. Thanks for having me, and nice to be with you guys.
I'll tell you what, we're excited about it.
I'm not sure you're really going uphill going from Peter Jacobson to me. I think that may be going downhill, because I can promise you, you will not open up next week with a song that Tom Kite sang. And you did that with Peter, so, you know, it's not going to happen next week. So you're going downhill, guys.
But, Tom, I got up bright and early this morning, and I popped open some images of you, and there you were working out in your skivvies in one of these pictures, and that was quite a sight at 4:30 in the morning, my friend. So you're right in the mix.
Well, see, that's what you get for going online.
Hey, Tom, we mentioned a little bit about your obviously the we'll get into the tour. You had a lot of our listeners send us questions to ask you and stuff, but I want to go back to to the Texas days when you were actually paired with, you know, Crenshaw and some of these great players of your era. What was that like for you? Just kind of reminisce a little bit about the college days.
Well, actually, it was pretty cool, Dan, because I grew up in Austin. We moved to Austin. Dad was transferred down here when I was 12 years old, and Ben was 10. And when we came down here, Dad joined the Austin Country Club, and so I had a chance to play a lot of golf under the guidance of Harvey Penick, and Ben was doing the same thing. But we were just 10 and 12 year old kids at the time, and believe me, the Austin Country Club had so many single digit handicap players around that it was just crazy, and there were probably 15 or 20. Juniors that were, a couple of years older than we were, that were really, really good, and are still playing some really good amateur golf around the Central Texas area. But at that time, Ben and I started our lifelong journey of competing with and against each other, and it carried all the way through, until this day. But we went to different junior highs, we went to different high schools. And so when we finally got to Texas, and I was a couple of years ahead of Ben, when I got there, it was kind of like, man, I'm tired of competing against this guy. I want him on my side. I want him on the same team as me. So when Coach Hannon started recruiting Ben, he asked all the guys on the team to try to help him out as much as they could, and I couldn't wait to have that happen. We had a pretty good run. Couple of national championships in there, and it was just great to get a chance to finally compete with him instead of against him.
Yeah, not a bad duo there at any college level. But Ben's relationship with Harvey is well documented, and you kind of flew. Did you fly under the radar with Harvey, Mr. Penick?
Not at all. I mean, we are kind of joined at the hip through all that stuff. Everybody knew that we were very instrumental in or he was very instrumental in our game and developing our ability to play and our ability to mature as young men. And it was just a great blessing to have that opportunity to do that. I mean, certainly, you know, what happened when Ben won the Masters on the heels of Harvey Penick passing away, that was very well documented. But, you know, I was at home at the time. I had not flown over to Augusta. I'm the one that called Ben and told him that Mr. Penick passed away. And then I went over and played a practice round at Augusta. And then we flew back with Terry Jestro, you know, the director of ABC Sports at the time, and a really good friend who had taken a lot of lessons from Harvey earlier. And so we all flew back together and were part of the ceremony to honor him and recognize his great contributions. And then we flew back to Augusta together, and Ben had that unbelievable run and won the Masters. And it's just a great tribute to Harvey Penick, for sure.
You know, we got a lot of things to talk to you about, Tom, but I want to ask you one more question about Mr. Penick. What is the one thing that he taught you that sticks with you today?
Well,
I know there's probably several, but...
Oh, yeah, I mean, it's a lifelong journey. You can't put everything that he taught me down into one sentence, but, you know, I've had a lot of people ask me what's the best advice that he ever gave me, and he kind of has this, or had this expression that he gave to a number of his students, and it was basically, I tell my students to go to dinner with good putters. And, you know.
That's why we never went to dinner. Now I know why Tom shined me like a boot.
He never took you to dinner, huh?
you know, it's funny. Everybody gets a chuckle out of that. They kind of laugh about it. But, Dan, if you think about it, to be a good putter, you can't have a crappy attitude. You got to have a great attitude. You got to have high expectations, and you got to expect good results. And basically, what Mr. Penick was telling all of us, not just me, but telling all of us, was hang around good, positive, upbeat people that would be a good influence on our careers and on our lives. And it goes more than just having somebody to go to dinner with, for sure, but it's a great piece of advice.
Yeah, well, I'm looking across from these two Hanyaks that I'm working with here, and I'm going, wow, did I pick the wrong thing? Neither one of them can putt.
We can't play.
We're going to radio, so here we go. But Shotgun, you got something, Tom.
And we'll always play to the level of our competition.
That's exactly what I say.
Exactly.
Dogs.
But, Tom, you talk about advice and advice Mr. Penny gave you. What other advice would you give a young tour pro out there, maybe starting out their first year on tour this year? What advice would you give them?
Yeah, I'd give them exactly the same thing.
Ageless.
I think, really, to not take advantage of the guys that went in front of you is something that I see happening more and more out on the PGA Tour, and it's a little bit disturbing. I don't quite understand it because, you know, when Dan and I were coming out on tour, my goodness, we just couldn't wait to go play practice rounds with the top players that were older and knew more than we did. You know, be it a Dave Stockton or a Charlie Cootie or a Lee Trevino or you know, whoever it was, Miller Barber, Don January. I mean, those guys were guys that were really, really good to me, and I tried to play as many practice rounds as I could with those guys, and I learned from them. Nowadays, you know, I see more and more of these guys surrounded with their own entourage. You know, you have a strength coach and a sports psychologist and a nutritionist and a teaching pro. And I think a lot of times those guys, that entourage tries to protect their position. And, you know, they keep the guy so insulated, keep the player so insulated, that the guy doesn't really have a chance to take advantage of all the great experience that the tour pros have that have gone before them. And I think that's kind of a shame.
Well, Tom, we've had
the great thing about it, though, is that we're starting to see a couple of young players realize that that's not the best way to do it. I mean, you know, Jordan Spieth taking advantage of Ben Crenshaw at Augusta this year is a perfect example of you know, really tapping into the knowledge that's out there ahead of you.
Yeah, we had Lanny on the show, and you can imagine his response to some of those questions like that, Tom. Yeah, he was pretty matter-of-fact about who was our psychiatrist and stuff in the day, and that was usually the bartender or whoever it may be. But let's jump around a little bit, because I've told these guys, you know, I've had the luxury of playing with a lot of great players, but to me you were, again, underrated overall. The players knew, you know, they had to beat Tom Kite in any event. But are you, when I look at you after we played the other day, one of the greatest ball strikers, especially a driver of the ball with the wooden clubs and stuff. Has the clubs now, because we know that players of our era have probably had to make the biggest changes because we really know what it was like to use those. Has it been a detriment to you a little bit on the equipment versus what most people would say is an advantage?
You know, Dan, I don't think so. You know, obviously, you know, we played just a couple weeks ago, and this is at the end of a very poor year for me. I had a lot of distractions. You know, my wife passed away in January after a pretty long battle with cancer. And then when I was just starting to come back and start playing again, I slipped at the senior PGA up at French Lick on the Pete Dye golf course up there and tore my meniscus. So I had to have that surgically repaired. And so this year has been kind of a bust.
Okay.
I'm really looking forward to next year and being able to, you know, try to improve on that stuff. But, you know, quite honestly, a lot of the new equipment came out in 2000. That was at the end of my career. 2000 was my first year on the Champions Tour. And, for those first, 4 years, 5 years, I split time between the PGA Tour and the Champions Tour as a number of players are doing right now. And that, quite honestly, that's some of the best golf that I ever played. You know, I think I set the record for the greens hit. I was leading in, you know, a lot of those categories. And I really had some good runs those first couple of years, first 4 or 5 years on the Champions Tour. Now, I don't think any of us that grew up with wooden-headed clubs and Bellotta balls are going to achieve the same type of benefit the guys that grew up with this light equipment and the new ball have been able to gain. But it helps everybody. There's no question about it. It makes the game easier. When you have the big-headed clubs and the balls that don't spin as much and tend to go straighter, that's something that really helps everybody in the game. Unfortunately, it helps the guys with a lot of speed, the guys that really hit it a long ways. It helps them more than it helps the other people. But everybody's a little bit of a benefit of the thing. But, you know, the part that concerns me is the fact that the really long hitters have had a much greater benefit off the new equipment than, you know, Uncle Harry and Aunt Agnes. You know, their game's improved a little bit or hasn't deteriorated quite as much, but they haven't benefited as much as Jason Day and Jordan Spieth and Roy McIlroy and all these guys that have grown up playing this new equipment.
Well, Tom, you talk about the equipment. Back in 1992, you shot an even par final round 72 at Pebble to win the U.S. Open. Where would you rank that round of golf in your career?
Well, certainly in the top two or three for me. You know, to shoot 72 when the stroke average, the average score that day was 78.8, you know, just shows you how difficult a golf course like Pebble Beach can be when the conditions turn ugly. And, you know, it was just a very difficult day, and there was only one other score that was better than 72 the entire day. And so I was really proud of that, especially the fact that there was already some good scores. Some of the earlier scores, you know, Colin Montgomery got in fairly early and posted a number, and we were out there facing disasters on every hole, and, you know, I was able to get it into the clubhouse and post a win. So I'm very proud of that round of golf that I played right there.
Did the golf course get away that day? Was it unfair in your opinion?
Yeah, and you know, I think you have a situation where, as the USGA and the PGA tend to do quite often, they really want to test the players, and you push the golf course to the limit on a daily basis. I mean, the greens are firm, the greens are fast, the fairways are tight, the rough is high. And when you have a situation where the weather conditions change from what was forecast, then all of a sudden something that was right at the edge all of a sudden goes over the edge. And that's what happened that day. It's happened a couple other times. It happened at Shinnecock a few years later. And they've tried to, I think Mike Davis with the USGA and Kerry Haig with the PGA have tried to soften that approach a little bit so they have a little bit of leeway in case conditions do turn.
Watson's pitch shot on 17 obviously followed, everybody follows that, but to me that chip you made on, or the pitch you made on 6, can you put a percentage number on that, Tom, of what the chances, if you've had to replicate that shot that you've made? It's one of those ones where I don't think anybody was getting within 8, 10, 12 feet.
So what are the odds in Vegas?
The odds in Vegas would have been very low.
Very, very low. I think the percentage would start out with something like a .00. And then what other numbers you want to add behind that. But, it's interesting when you think about the guys that have won at Pebble Beach out there. Lanny won the PGA Championship. Jack won the U.S. Open in 72. Watson won in 82. I won in 92. Tiger won in 2000. And then Graham McDowell won in 2010. That's a pretty nice list to have your name associated with.
Yeah. Well, you named a lot of names that have been on our show here. Mm-hmm. And I like to ask them, we have so many accomplished players on it, but I always ask them, what's been their most embarrassing moment in golf, Tom? Because I've explained to these guys some of the things that I've that I've almost fallen down on. But is there one that you can pick out where you say, oh, man, I'd like to have that time over?
Yeah, I mean, but I got to go way, way back. You know, we had just moved to Austin, Texas when I was 12 years old, as I said, and we had joined the Austin Country Club, and I thought I was kind of a hotshot 12-year-old player at the time, and we were playing with a couple of the juniors, and it was a Saturday afternoon, and Harvey Penick is acting as a starter. He sent us off the back nine. And so we were up there on the 10th tee, and all of a sudden, a group of members who Harvey had also directed to go off the backside pulled up behind us. And, I mean, these were the bigwigs of the club. And, I mean, these were the guys that you heard about just moving in the club, and they were very influential. And, I was going to show them how good I was. And I reared back on the tee shot, made a long backswing, came down and hit behind it, took a divot, and the club bounced right over the ball. And literally, the ball is still sitting there. I literally could have crawled in that divot at that moment, and I just absolutely died. You know, obviously, there have been a lot more shots that were far costlier than that. But as I've grown older, I've learned not to get embarrassed by the four shots that I've hit and the stupid things that I've done, but just try to go on and learn from them.
Embrace them, and that's what's fun about this game.
Hey, we had Jack on. Hey, Tom, with Jack, his moment was when he shanked one into Bobby Jones.
Twelfth hole, Augusta, shanked it over to the right, almost took him out of the cart.
Golly, well, if that's the case, I didn't know about that, but if that's the case, I'm surprised he ever won the Masters. He probably shouldn't have ever got an invitation there to go.
Arnold fell on the creek at Sedgefield. He said he's going across, and all of a sudden he falls right in the creek.
I remember that. I remember that one, that's for sure.
Don't you guys love the trip down memory lane? I do, because I don't get the same feel as I do when I talk about the 70s and the 80s in golf, 60s, 70s, and 80s as I do today. Tom, do you know where I'm headed with this, kind of, or not? Or am I just on an island by myself?
No, I don't think you're on an island by yourself, but you're dating yourself.
I know.
Sure.
I know that for sure.
Yeah. No, I think we kind of got into a moment in time or a period of time on the PGA Tour where, you know, everybody was really commenting on the lack of personalities and the lack of names out there. And, you know, basically I attribute it to, you know, Tiger was such a great player, but he didn't give a whole lot back. You know, he wasn't very approachable. He wasn't, you know, he didn't sign autographs the way all of us had been taught by Arnold Palmer and Jack Nicklaus and Gary Player and Trevino to sign. You know, he didn't do that. He didn't really socialize with the gallery. I mean, he was a great player, and everybody loved him and loved to watch his golf. But in terms of, you know, a relationship with the public and the media, he didn't have that.
Yeah.
I think right now, though, I'm real excited about what's going on in the professional game. I think there are some personalities and some names out there that are so captivating and so fun to watch, and it's going to be, I think the next 10 years on the PGA Tour, next 15 years, is just going to be one of the most exciting times when you think about a Roy McIlroy and Jason Day and Jordan Spieth and Ricky Fowler and you know, Justin Rose and guys like that that are just not only great personalities and great players, but they're really nice people.
Sure.
And I think they understand that they've got to give a little bit back, and I love the 70s. I'm back there with you. Heck, I lived in that. The 70s and 80s were great.
Yep.
But I think we're about to embark on the next version of that.
Yeah, turning the page. Our producer is dying to get in on a question. The gas man, go ahead.
Thanks.
Talk to Mr. Kite.
Yeah, first of all, it's a pleasure to speak with you right now. But I read online that you were the first golfer to add a third.
Ooh, I'm sorry, I can't hear it.
You can't hear me?
Plug the mic in.
I'll relay the question.
I just wanted about the third wedge and what the degrees were and why to do
that. Okay, you were the first guy. This is from a producer. The gas man said that he read it. You were the first guy to add a third wedge to your bag. And what was the degrees of your wedges?
Well, back then, the most lofty club that anybody used was a 56-degree sand wedge. And people still had 2 irons and 3 irons in the bag. And you know, even some guys that were good had 1 irons in there. But Dave Pels came to me in 1979, and he had been following me and a couple other guys, Andy North, Jim Simons, and Tom Jenkins around. And he convinced all of us, or convinced me for sure, that as good as our short games were, they could be a little bit better. And he was an advocate of adding a more lofted club in there, and gave us some statistics and showed us some things. And I incorporated it and put it in my bag in the middle of 1980 and totally changed my game and, you know, to some extent changed the way everybody's set up in their bag is now. 1981, my first full year with it, I was leading money winner. I'd never finished better than 14th on the money list prior to that time. Had been very consistent, never had been, I'd always been an exempt player, made the top 60, but had never finished better than 14th. In my first full year, I was leading money winner. And then went a decade and never finished out of the top 10. And at that time became the career leading money winner, which you alluded to earlier. You know, it was a great time for me. And that club revolutionized my game, and it took about 2 or 3 years before a couple of other people started putting it in, and now you don't see anybody that doesn't. Well, I mean, 58 would be you know, the least amount of loft that everybody carries in their bag. A lot of people have 60, 61, 62, and even some guys have 64 and 65 degrees in their bag right now. So it's one of the things that you know, back in the early 80s, the makeup of everybody's bag changed dramatically.
Yeah, great, great stuff, by the way, Tom. And for our listeners who haven't had a chance to sit and listen to Tom Kite, this is really informative and really we're so happy that you would join us today, Tom. But I got to ask you, if Tom Kite was not a golfer, he would be blank. Because we know that you go back to now, 12 years old, when you started this journey, or probably before then, when you go back, really deep into the into the thought. But is there anything else that would really excite you outside of this game?
Well, I mean, if I was actually going to fill in the blank, I'd say probably destitute and out on the corner, carrying cardboard signs and, just trying to figure out. No, I love architecture, always have, and if I had not been able to make it playing golf, I would have gone into some sort of architecture. I've been fortunate enough to have designed and co-designed 14 golf courses, so it allows me to combine the love of architecture with the golf. But quite honestly, if I was not able to play golf right now, I'd be designing homes.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Well, I'd like to. I'll buy one of them if you go ahead and design it. But, hey, and then
only if you like contemporary. I'm into contemporary.
And we all have so many questions. We're sitting here around the table, yeah, just kind of point. But I got to know, just from my standpoint, is there anything in this game that you haven't accomplished in your own mind?
Oh gosh, yes, Dan.
Okay.
I mean, no, you can't ask anybody, and I don't care. Tiger. Jack, Lee, Gary, Arnold, I mean, Bobby Jones, I mean, you ask anybody, yes. I mean, we've all lost tournaments. We've all let tournaments slip away. We've all had tournaments taken away from us. We've, we can probably always look back and say, golly, I wish I had handled that encounter with that spectator a little bit better than I did, or whatever. But, yeah, I mean, I'm fortunate that I've had a good career. I mean, I'm very pleased with it. Could it have been better? Yeah, it could have been. I could have closed a few tournaments a little bit better than I did. But on the other hand, I got a nice share of tournaments, so I feel pretty good about my career. Could have been better, but it could have been a whole lot worse. So I feel very blessed to do it. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of stuff that I didn't get accomplished, and there are a couple things that right now I turn 66 next month, and as you saw when we played together in California last week or 2 weeks ago, I've got a little bit of work to do to try to get my game back, and now that I feel like I'm healthy and I'm getting my life grounded again, I'm really looking forward to the challenge of trying to become a decent player at age 66.
Well, Tom, you've had 19 wins on the PGA Tour in 29 seconds. You're talking about not getting it done sometimes. Is there one tournament that sticks out in your mind where you didn't get it done that still to this day kind of sticks in your craw?
The one that at the time hurt the most was the 89 U.S. Open at Oak Hill with Curtis ultimately ended up winning the tournament. I was leading the tournament through three rounds and had a three-shot lead through the fourth hole of the final round. It was just playing great. I mean, I had everything going and was just really hitting the ball well. And I blocked the tee ball to the right on number five into the water, where I ended up dropping it. I had to lay up and chipped on the green, and then I compounded the mistakes by three putting, missing a very short putt. So I ended up making triple bogey. All of a sudden, that three-shot lead was zero, and opened up the door for everybody else. And there's one swing right there that I'd love to have back again.
That's interesting. Now we've held you on, Tom, and any of our listeners who have not enjoyed this are either dead or
don't have a brain.
We should shoot them.
Yeah. Or they're headed to the bowling alley.
Exactly.
You probably got a lot of listeners that are sitting there going, Tom, who?
No. We emailed this out to a lot of people. We got a lot of response, but I can't thank you enough. I know that Buck is got to kind of wrap this up here, but we're all wishing you. And again, our heartfelt condolences on your loss.
Absolutely.
Of Christy. And I know that the kids are kind of spread out. You just came back. We were texting back and forth. And just give us a little, you know, taste of where the kids are and how important they're, a part they're playing in this, you know, later development for you?
Transition.
Well, they're a huge part. You know, I kid them an awful lot that they turned out pretty good in spite of their parents, and they have turned out to be really, really good citizens, and I'm very proud of them. And my daughter, Stephanie, lives in Birmingham, and she is married and now just had a baby boy that is 3.5 months old named Brant, who's just absolutely terrific. One of my sons, David, lives in Charleston, South Carolina. He's married and has a little adopted girl that's 2.5 years old and just absolutely just gorgeous, except she's going through terrible twos right now. and then my other son lives up in New York, and he's an actor and finished up a little off-Broadway play called Dracula.
Oh.
And he had a nice role there, so he's doing very well. So I've got... 3 terrific kids and 2 grandkids, and it's fantastic right now. They have they've been the glue that has helped me hold everything together this year.
That's well, awesome you're stuff. I got to tell you from the personal standpoint, you're one of those guys that I've always admired, and always the work ethic that you brought to the game is sometimes. You know, you watch what VJ has done, and you know that we always talk about how many balls he hit. But you like to do that too.
I do. I enjoy trying to figure out how to play this game, and you know, it's a never ending search, as you know. I mean, you think you have it, but then you wake up the next morning, you know, it's not there. So it's had a great time with it, and it's great to be with you guys this morning.
Perfect.
Thank you, Tom.
Tom, well, thank you so much for joining us this morning. Are you still working out like you were? Because I just want to leave you on a lighter note. If you're looking for another opportunity, I know you're a big workout hound. I hear they're accepting applications.
It's a new calendar, too. We had Jake on. There was the old calendar that they were. You're not starting up a calendar, are you, Tom?
No, I'm definitely not starting up a calendar. That's for sure. Okay. That might be the most embarrassing moment right there.
Hey, we just like to have, you know, golf's fun. We love to have fun when people put a smile on people's face, and you definitely did that today with your whole storyline. So, Tom, thank you very much for joining us. We wish you the best and hope we can get you back on again sometime in the future.
I'd love it. That would be great. And, Dan, look forward to seeing you at a few more tournaments out there. Come on out.
My pleasure, my friend. And, again, thanks a lot, and the best for the holidays.
Yep.
You bet. Thank you, guys.
There
thanks
he goes. Tom Kite, Hall of Famer, Vardon Trophy winner, 19 victories, 7 Ryder Cups. Made more money than a god. I swear I'm looking at it.
He's made a bunch.
And what a gentleman.
Yes.